From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writing for Bart, Lisa, Marge, and Homer, we meet Al Jean and Mike Reese, writers for The Simpsons. They've been with the show since it went on the air. Also, we talk to comic John Lovitz, formerly of Saturday Night Live. He's featured in the new movie, A League of Their Own. TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at the not-so-conventional coverage of the Democratic Convention. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Stranger Among Us, starring Melanie Griffith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court said today that the federal government can keep the French-made abortion pills it seized from a pregnant California woman who tried to bring them into the United States. The justices voted 7-2 to reject the emergency appeal filed by Leona Benton, the 29-year-old social worker who brought in RU486 in a direct challenge to Food and Drug Administration policy. Benton's lawyers said that she's 7.5 weeks pregnant and that if she didn't get the pills by tomorrow, she would exceed the medically recommended period for using them. The new Democratic ticket is taking its campaign on the road. Bill Clinton and Al Gore are planning to cover 9 states in 6 days. Their first stop was Camden, New Jersey. Doug Schlatter of member station WHYY reports.
The major theme of this bus tour is unemployment, a message that Clinton and Gore will be barnstorming from New Jersey to Missouri. Their first stop was at the General Electric Aerospace plant in Camden, where Governor Clinton blasted the Bush administration for not doing enough for workers. Clinton said he wants to help people keep their jobs, a key issue in Camden, one of the nation's most depressed cities.
The program Al Gore and I will bring to America will invest more money in American jobs, in bringing American jobs home and creating American jobs, invest more money in partnerships between government, business, labor, and education, to make government work for ordinary people again, not just for organized interests.
The Clinton campaign said that Democrats were already getting a big response from former supporters of Ross Perot. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Schlatter reporting.
Two French soldiers serving with the United Nations in Croatia were killed today in a landmine explosion on the Adriatic coast. They were the first UN soldiers to die in the Yugoslav conflict. The deaths came as the leaders of Bosnia's 3 warring factions signed a ceasefire agreement today in London. They also agreed to come back for more talks in about a week. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
The 2-week ceasefire is scheduled to begin at 6 o'clock local time on Sunday evening. It calls for all heavy weapons and aircraft to be put under UN supervision and for all refugees displaced by the fighting to be allowed to return to their homes. Previous ceasefires called in Bosnia have quickly collapsed, but EC mediator Lord Carrington said he hoped this one would be different.
I think this one could be different because of what they've agreed to with the heavy weapons, but we must wait and see what happens. I don't think we want to be too optimistic and not too pessimistic.
Fighting continued today on several fronts in Bosnia, where more than 7,000 people have been killed in violence that began after the Republic's Muslims and Croats voted in March for independence from Yugoslavia, a move opposed by Bosnia's Serbs. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 30 points to close at 3,331.6. This is NPR News. The Israeli army lifted its siege of the largest Palestinian university in the occupied West Bank today, allowing about 3,000 students and staff members to leave the campus. The siege was ended in exchange for the surrender of 6 Palestinian leaders who were immediately expelled from the occupied territories. Red Cross officials drove the 6 to the border where they crossed the Allenby Bridge into Jordan. Under an agreement reached between university officials and the Israeli army, the 6 may return to the West Bank after 3 years. The 4-day siege was seen as a test of how the new government of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin will deal with Palestinian issues. The UN Security Council today appointed former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance as the world body's special envoy to South Africa. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali said Vance will go to South Africa next week to begin his mission. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Diplomats expressed hope that the appointment of Cyrus Vance as special envoy to South Africa will lead to reducing political violence and the resumption of constitutional talks. The United Nations Security Council created the post of Special Representative following a session this week on growing political violence that has swept South Africa's black townships. Vance will meet next week in South Africa with various political groups before reporting back to the Security Council with recommendations. The African National Congress and some African nations want the UN to establish a permanent presence in South Africa, which the South African government opposes. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Police in South Africa said that nearly 80 people will be charged in the massacre of at least 42 last month in the black township of Boipatong. The suspects were residents of a workers' hostel reputed to be a stronghold of the Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party. The massacre caused the African National Congress to break off political reform talks with the government and to accuse government security forces of aiding the killers. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Dear purveyors of senseless violence, I know this may sound silly at first, but I believe that the cartoons you show to our children are influencing their behavior in a negative way. Please try to tone down the psychotic violence in your otherwise fine programming. Yours truly, Marge Simpson.
Take a letter, Miss White. Dear valued viewer, thank you for taking an interest in the Itchy and Scratchy program. Enclosed is a personally autographed photo of America's favorite cat and mouse team to add to your collection. In regards to your specific comments about the show, our research indicates that one person cannot make a difference, no matter how big a screwball she is. So let me close by saying...
And the horse I rode in on! I'll show them what one screwball can do!
That was one of the great episodes of The Simpsons in which Marge campaigned against cartoon violence. The Simpsons were created by cartoonist Matt Groening and first appeared as a regular feature on The Tracey Ullman Show. My guests Al Jean and Michael Reese have been writing for The Simpsons ever since the series hit prime time in January of 1990. Jean and Reese have also written for The Tonight Show, It's Gary Shandling Show, and Sledgehammer. They've been partners since their college days at Harvard, and they're just two of the many writers written about in an article on how Harvard changed comedy, published in the current issue of Harvard Magazine. The Simpsons episode in which Marge takes her stand against cartoon violence is a favorite around here, so I asked Jean and Reese about how and why they wrote it.
The cartoons that they watched on The Simpsons, the Itchy and Scratchy show, were extremely violent, so she led a crusade and actually got them to tone down their violence, and the cartoons were really pathetic without violence. They were really lame. So kids didn't watch them, and then they went out and they started, riding bikes and building things and having fun, and, you know, it seemed like a golden age, but then... Michelangelo's David was going to tour Springfield, and then the same people that wanted to censor the cartoons wanted to put pants on the statue, and Marge realized that you can't really censor one thing without saying that censorship is okay in all forms. For a children's show, or, you know, quote-unquote children's show, it really had a lot to say.
And also, it's sort of typical of a Simpsons episode, which is it made a lot of points that all canceled each other out. The show really doesn't have a platform.
The other thing is we're sort of crusading against violent cartoons, but of course we got the show about 10 minutes of very violent cartoons, so we were kind of playing both ends against the middle.
Well, the violent cartoons that you show are Itchy and Scratchy, which kind of regularly appear in the series. And, all they do is just kind of, like, beat on each other with a hammer. I mean, that's the whole, there is no plot, or there's not even as much plot as there is in a Roadrunner cartoon.
No, in fact, they average about 6 seconds long. So if it was a real cartoon, you really wouldn't, you know, get much out of them.
We generally even spend longer writing the title of the cartoon than writing the rest of it. Something like Bang the Cat Slowly. was one title, and that took about 2 hours, and the rest of the cartoon was pretty easy to do.
Have you ever gotten angry responses from the equivalent of people who want to censor violent cartoons? People who complain about how the family is portrayed on The Simpsons.
You know, we used to get complaints, especially when the Underachiever T-shirt was really prominent. But I think that a lot of people, when they watch the show and they actually sit down and look at it, realize that the show actually has a strong moral center. And in fact, when people on The Simpsons do something wrong, it's almost like they get punished far worse than people would in real life.
Didn't Dan Quayle once say something about The Simpsons?
No, his boss, George Bush, said America should be more like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons. And we did a rejoinder a couple of days later where Bart said, "We are like the Waltons. We're all praying for an end to the Depression."
So I hope that doesn't get the show killed. But...
And I didn't see it a couple of weeks ago, but I heard you did something in response to Dan Quayle's Murphy Brown. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was in response to Dan Quayle's potato misspelling.
Yeah, this was actually Matt's idea. We had we have the chalkboard at the beginning of the show, and those are actually done about a few days in advance. So after Quayle's incident, we just had Bart writing on the chalkboard, potato, spelled correctly, not potato with the extra E that Dan Quayle put on. So that's just our little kick.
You've been writing for The Simpsons since it became a TV, a regular scheduled TV series. What was it like at the beginning when you were taking over from Matt Groening, who did a shorter version of it for the Tracy Ullman show?
Well, at the very start, Matt, in addition to Sam Simon and Jim Brooks, the two other executive producers on the show, wanted to take these little, 2-minute shorts and turn them into a series, which, at the time seemed a lot more difficult than people may think now. And Mike and I had just been on the Gary Shandling show, and, we took the job because, frankly, we had no other offers. And we were kind of embarrassed because we were writing for a cartoon, and we thought, geez, I don't know if this is going to go anywhere. Although we thought that the stories they were throwing out were really funny, and, we were the first staff writers. And then when the first episode, the first full-length episode aired at Christmas of 1989, we had a jacket from the show, and I went to Epcot Center, and suddenly everybody was like coming up to me and saying, "That was the greatest show. Can I buy your jacket?" And, it was like fights breaking out around me and things like that. And it was just surprising. We said, "Gee, this is, really something special."
Did you relate to the family when you started writing for them? And I'm wondering, as Harvard guys, did you relate to this like working class dysfunctional family?
Well, both of us went to public school, and I think our families are a little more similar to The Simpsons than we'd care to admit.
And as we get older, right, we see we're all becoming a little more like Homer than we'd like to admit. We all get very happy when someone brings a box of donuts into the room, and we smack our lips a lot more than we used to.
Now, how do you work with the animators? Do you write the scripts first and then hand it over to them?
Yeah, the first thing we do is write the script and then record the audio track with the cast.
We record it like a radio show. It takes about 8 hours, and we cut it down to about 19 minutes of audio track. And then that's sent to the animators, who expand it to about 24 minutes.
We have a team of 6 guys who are terrific. They direct the way a movie director directs a feature, and they take the script and they pretty much stage the whole thing, design the characters, and then we see a real rough version in black and white called an animatic. We do some rewrites there, and then we send the whole thing to Korea, and that's where the actual color animation is done. It comes back about 3 months later. So right now we just finished recording our Valentine's Day show for 93.
You're really working far ahead.
Yeah, we really are. In fact, in about a month, we will be pitching out what will be our season premiere in 93, September 93.
Nobody's this
far ahead. We have to work. And it's sort of a good thing, which is we throw in some topical allusions, but I think it's going to make the show a little more, it'll be a little timeless because we can't ride every current thing and get a quick laugh off of something that's in the news right now.
A bad thing that happens is we'll use a name like Rex Harrison or somebody, and then he'll die before the show airs, so we have to change it. It's sort of like there's a curse. And then we did a big joke about the Soviet Union and it die. So we have to just kind of be careful.
We had a little thing where Jackie Mason appeared on the show, and they flew to New York to record him, and he just made some reference to Isaac Bashevis Singer. And then a couple of months later, reading the paper, Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Isaac Bashevis Singer dies. Oh, no. And we had to fly back to New York and get him to replace the line with Saul Bellow. And then for the next 2 months, we were praying, "Saul Bellow, please don't die." And, these prayers were going out to him, and I think he didn't know why.
Some of my favorite episodes are ones with guest stars like Jackie Mason or Joe Mantegna. How did you start working with guest stars like that?
Well, initially, people who were friends of the producers, for example, Danny DeVito is a friend of Jim Brooks, would express interest in doing the show. A big reason is that they have kids, and their kids would like to see them on the show. That's how Sting agreed to do it. His kids were fans. And then, you know, it's sort of a snowball thing. It's just we found that, you know, people like doing the show because it's an easy job and they can come in for a couple hours. We'll even go to them. And then we, you know, we of course really enjoy writing for these people. So this season we got a lot coming up. We have Bob Hope. We have Tom Jones.
Adam West, the original Batman. That really got everyone excited.
We have Sarah Gilbert from Roseanne, who plays a girl that Bart falls in love with for his first crush.
Danny DeVito will be back. Joe Frazier's on. It's been sort of a wish list. It's a lot of people, I think, that our staff wanted to meet.
Mike, I understand that in back of your desk you have a picture of Maury Amsterdam, who played Buddy, one of the writers on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
How'd that get out?
You know, it's in that Harvard Magazine article about comedy writers who are alums of Harvard.
Now, he is wearing clothes in the photo. I hope that...
So, did watching the Dick Van Dyke Show make you really want to write for television?
Absolutely. It's and Maury Amsterdam was my hero, the way Hank Aaron would be some normal kid's hero. I just loved the show, and... Dick Van Dyke lived in New Rochelle, so I started dating a girl from New Rochelle, and I didn't like the town, and I didn't like her very much. But, yeah, it was a huge influence on me, and...
I think a lot of comedy writers saw that and said, you know, that's what I want to do for a living. My favorite show was The Honeymooners, so I wanted to really be poor and live in a terrible apartment.
Well, do you see The Simpsons as being, in a way, like The Honeymooners with kids?
Yes, I think there is an influence. I mean, that was a great show. And what was good about that show that we hope to emulate is, besides being really funny, you really felt that the characters were real. You really thought that they had a slice of life and that they, you know, taught you a little bit about the human condition. And if we're good, we hope we do that, too.
Let me ask you about the character of Krusty the Clown, you know, who's a regular on The Simpsons. When you were kids, did you used to watch any shows with clowns, and did you really hate the clowns?
Actually, I was on the Bozo show in Detroit where I grew up, and I had a Krusty-like incident where I was, you know, about 8 years old, and I was in the audience, and Krusty came in to Bozo came in to talk to the kids, and he sat on me, and I didn't realize just watching on TV he's really heavy, he's like 200 pounds, so that was very traumatic. You know, maybe that influences us a little.
Were you a regular on the show, or was it just
no.
in the audience?
Yes, I got sat on every week.
It was Sideshow Al.
No, just one time. It was like, you know, one of those things where you had to, you know, write, you know, for weeks in advance to get tickets, and, you know, I went on my birthday, and so there's a little bit of that. You know, what's funny is we hear from people who work with, you know, clowns, you know, who say, you wouldn't believe how true Krusty is. You know? I guess these clowns don't treat their employees very well.
I had a friend who worked for Bozo Enterprises, and he said there was an incident they hushed up in Chicago or somewhere where the Chicago Bozo, I don't want to offend whichever Bozo, there's one bad Bozo that can ruin it for everyone, but apparently the Bozo had jumped on some production assistant, and they were pulling him off her, and he said, she wanted it from me. She wanted it from me in the suit.
Oh, boy. did you like kid shows when you were growing up, or did you find them insipid?
Oh, we were kids, you know. Mm-hmm. When you're a kid, you like kid shows. You don't know what else there is. But, you know, now I say that, you know, there's definitely different levels of quality to these shows. You know, and there's ones that I liked as a kid that I don't like as much now.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Al Jean and Mike Reese. They're both executive producers of The Simpsons. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about The Simpsons with two of the show's executive producers, Al Jean and Mike Reese. You wrote for The Tonight Show together for a year.
Mm-hmm.
What were you writing, sketches or monologues?
We wrote the sketches. We wrote Carnax. Pretty much anything that's written that isn't the monologue is what we did. There's, you know, obviously back when Johnny was still the host.
And we wrote what was like desk material, which would be like Johnny's 10 tips to beat the heat and that kind of thing.
Was that fun to do?
Yeah, it was interesting because we actually didn't see Johnny very much, nor did we have much contact with the other writers. We just sort of sat in our office and would write. Pretty much we wrote 60 jokes a day, so 300 a week. Not that they were all good jokes, mind you, but we would hand them in. And it was just sort of like being, at the Latin American Bureau of IBM or something.
Yeah.
You'd come in, you'd do your little bit, and then you would go. And
It was so compartmentalized, too, that there was a staff of sketch writers and a staff of monologue writers, and they were in separate buildings across the studio lot from each other. And I guess in our 2 years there, we never met all the monologue writers. And in all that time, we maybe spent an hour with Carson total. He never knew who we were.
Well, that must have felt pretty odd. You're supposed to be writing something for someone who you really understand so well that you know what makes them tick and what their sense of humor is. I guess maybe you knew that from watching him for so many years.
No, that's about it. I think he's a private man, and, we would just watch the show like other people did, just for, clues to what he wanted and, what he was like.
It's funny. Carson's of such a different generation than you are. You graduated Harvard in 81. So did you feel like you had to really write for somebody who was very different from you and would have a really different sense of humor from you?
What we were trying to do is just sort of, keep the show current, but, also write things like Karnak and The Edge of Wetness, which are his old standbys. So it was sort of in the middle of that, the one thing he does, though, he would try to keep references to topical material. I mean, the show was always, doing a monologue about what happened that day. But we wouldn't always do, the latest MTV reference or something.
It was weird to just get in his mindset. When we were working there, we were just two single guys trying to get dates all the time. But when we'd be writing for him, it would always be about divorces and divorce lawyers.
Yeah, crummy lawyers. we're going,
how bad the food is in Malibu, things like that.
How does an extremely wealthy man think?
right. Let me get back to the Simpsons. Are there aspects of your family life that you've ever written into an episode?
Since we work on the show all the time, there, is maybe 1 hour's worth of family life a week, but we do suck that into the show. I mean, we do draw from anything that happens to us.
Yeah, it's because we can pour everything into the show. I think it does draw on everybody's childhood. We've really sucked everyone dry at the show. And what I'm actually curious to see this coming season, I've thrown a lot of my family's traumas into the show, and I haven't told them, and I'm going to see if they recognize them and if they get mad at me.
Can I ask you to give an example of something that happened in your lives, either as children or as adults, in your family that you've used on an episode?
A little one would be when we were kids, my dad would want us to say grace, and my sister would go, rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, and he'd get really mad. So we put that in an episode with Bart. Let's see.
There's one coming up next season where Homer wants Bart to have a nice bed. So he builds these clown beds for him that have a big clown head on the front and big feet at the foot of the bed, and the premise is you're supposed to be happy because you're sleeping in a clown's guts. And Homer paints this very grotesque clown face on the clown, and it gives Bart nightmares, and he's very scared, and he wants to stay as far from the beds as possible. And this is something that actually my father did when I was a kid.
He made a bed like that for you?
He made a clown bed, and the face was so creepy. It had these dark, sunken eyes and big, black, flaring nostrils that the kids finally sawed the heads off the clowns and stuck them in the closet with the faces facing the back wall.
That's great. When I was a kid, I used to have dreams about psychotic clowns and menacing Santa Clauses.
Now, we have a friend also from Harvard who was petrified by a clown when he was a kid and had nightmares about clowns for years, and he finally turned it into a new Fox series called Circus, where it is just about what horrible people clowns are.
Were you good kids when you were growing up?
Yeah, pretty good.
Pretty decent. Bookworms and
we were nerds, we'll admit it.
Yeah.
So you weren't Bart Simpson types?
No, I don't think anyone was exactly like that. You'd have to have a lot of energy to be that mischievous all the time.
No, I'm afraid most of our staff was a bunch of Lisa Simpsons.
Yeah, that's actually, if there's one character we relate to most, completely when we're writing, I think it's Lisa. I mean, Bart's really funny, but we relate to Homer when we're hungry.
Are there any changes coming up in the characters for next season?
No, one advantage of being animated is that we can, you know, our characters don't have to grow older. You know, we don't have to have, like, kids age, you know, poorly like Teeny Others did on Family Ties. And we can just sort of stay. Bart's always 10, Lisa's always 8. The relationships between the family are always the same.
What we generally do, and it's our advantage over most shows, is that it can expand outward. We can always just go more places. We instead of people getting sick of seeing the same 6 characters every week, we probably have a repertory company of about 40 or 50 regular characters that we can keep bringing back. So it always seems a lot fresher, I think, but that's why we don't have to send the family to Hawaii for a 6-episode, you know, stint.
There are a couple things. Like I mentioned, you know, Bart falls in love for the first time, and Maggie will actually talk. We'll say her first word, but I'm not at liberty to disclose what that word is.
She's not going to graduate from her pacifier, is she?
No, she'll keep the pacifier.
No, she'll say her first
word. We know a good
word,
thing.
And then nothing again, so it's even a little sad.
The Simpsons has a reputation for keeping the writers working really, really hard. And from what you've said, it sounds like, you know, you're working all the time and you're also working really far ahead. It sounds like a real grind sometimes. I mean, do you have to work that far ahead?
Well, there's a couple factors. One is with the animation, you do have to work, you know, 8 months ahead because it's just required.
Sure,
A lot of it, too, is the writers are self-motivated. You have people who are... The show has had such a high standard, at least we feel that way, that no one wants to be the one who let it slip. You know, no one wants to be the one that wrote the really crummy episode or... And, I mean, it's partly to the credit of all these people that work on it. The cast, too. I mean, everybody just... you know, realizes that they have a unique opportunity and nobody, you know, wants to let it go downhill. I've been in some great shows, but I've seen, you know, this one has just this remarkable level of achievement that it's been able to consistently maintain. It's really unbelievable.
So do you hope to stay in TV for a long time?
It's, you know, we've been working at this furious pace for the past 3 years on The Simpsons, and then it's Gary Shandling show for the 2 years before that was another long haul, a very, very long hour. So I think when we're done at The Simpsons, we'd at least like to decompress and take a job that's a little less pressure. I think if you could get normal hours on a sitcom job, a 40-hour-a-week job, I think I'd do it forever. It's an awful lot of fun, but it's just there are very few shows like that.
Yeah, I hope to work till my second stroke.
As professional comedy writers, do you quip a lot around the house, like characters in sitcoms always do?
At home, it's more like, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, well, there's the baby. I better go say hello. We do have a lot of laughs around the office, but it's never about the script.
Yeah.
The fun stuff is always just talking about, you know, the elections or, you know, things that when we're wasting time and we're not, you know, doing things that are connected with the show, that's fun.
It's really as funny as it gets. It'll be rolling and everyone's laughing and then someone's got to say, well, let's get back to those damn Simpsons.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
Al Jean and Mike Reese are executive producers of The Simpsons. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air.
I've got a bratty brother. He bugs me every day.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the pathological liar, annoying man, master thespian, and Harry Hanukkah. We talked to comic John Lovitz, former cast member of Saturday Night Live. Now he's featured in the new movie, A League of Their Own. Also, TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at the unconventional coverage of the Democratic Convention. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews A Stranger Among Us, starring Melanie Griffith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court refused to let a pregnant California woman take custody of the French abortion drug she brought into New York City. The justices released their 7-2 decision this evening. They denied Leona Benton's emergency request to lift an appellate court restraining order that barred the return of the RU486 pills to her. Benton pressed the issue because she said she needed to take the drug by tomorrow or else face a surgical abortion. RU486 is legally available in both Great Britain and France, where it's been used by more than 100,000 women. It has not been approved for use in the United States. Bill Clinton and Al Gore began their first 1,000-mile tour today. They left New York City for a trip through the Northeast and Midwest after a rally in New York City. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Bill Clinton bagged his first prize in the battle for the Perot people today. He appeared at a Midtown Manhattan rally with a group of top New York Perot supporters, including Thomas Hoving, former director of the Metropolitan Museum and a Republican.
You cannot stay out. All those people who thought Ross Perot had guts and he don't must come back to the obvious choice who has guts. He's proven it. And I ask you, who on this platform has that?
Like a representative of a conquered country, the New York field director for Perot, John Zaubler, handed over his Perot credentials. Then he was pinned with a Clinton-Gore button. The Clinton-Gore bus caravan first stopped in Camden, New Jersey, where Clinton and Gore spoke to defense industry workers at a GE plant. In Camden, I'm Mara Liasson.
Israel deported 6 Palestinians to Jordan today, ending a 4-day standoff between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian students at a West Bank university. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem. The Palestinians' agreement to be deported diffuses Yitzhak Rabin's first political crisis since being sworn in as Israeli prime minister on Monday.
The 6 armed Palestinian activists, together with some 3,000 students, had barricaded themselves inside Al-Najah University in Nablus since Tuesday. The standoff between the students and the Israeli army began when soldiers arrested an armed Palestinian near the university while student elections were being held. Troops surrounded the campus, demanding the surrender of several other Palestinian fugitives they said were on the campus. Student leaders refused and said no one would leave as long as the army was there. The students, including 800 women and a dozen children, ran out of food 2 days ago. Late today, Palestinian leaders brokered a compromise between the students and the army in which the wanted men would be allowed to leave if they accepted expulsion to Jordan. The Palestinians were escorted off campus by the Red Cross to the Allenby Bridge connecting the West Bank with Jordan. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow lost nearly 30 points to end the day at 33.31. This is NPR. Vice President Dan Quayle rushed to recruit Ross Perot's supporters today. He met with leaders of the Texas billionaire's abandoned presidential campaign and asked them to back President Bush. The vice president campaigned in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Florida today, and members of the Bush-Quayle reelection team in Washington contacted Perot officials in every state. The problem for Mr. Bush is that many of Perot's supporters are angry at the president, particularly at his economic policies. Administration officials also flatly denied a rumor that the vice president would be replaced on the ticket. South African police today announced that 78 people will be charged in connection with last month's massacre in the township of Boipatang. The murders led to the breakdown of negotiations on South Africa's political future. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
A police statement said residents of a black migrant workers' hostel near Boy Patong will be formally charged on Monday for their alleged role in the late-night rampage that left at least 43 dead. The African National Congress, charging government complicity in the massacre, cut off political talks with the government and appealed for a United Nations investigation of the escalating violence here. Former American Secretary of State Cyrus Vance is expected to arrive early next week as the UN's emissary. The prospect of international scrutiny may have speeded up the Boy Patong prosecutions as the government seeks to shed its image of tolerating and facilitating violence in the black townships. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Czechoslovak President Václav Havel says he'll resign next week. He's apparently giving up hope the nation could be saved from breaking in two. His announcement came minutes after Slovakia's parliament declared its sovereignty from Czechoslovakia. President Havel was blocked in his bid to be reelected as president earlier this month. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Throughout the Democratic National Convention, our TV critic David Bianculli was watching and recording seven networks at once. His verdict? TV coverage this year is just as unconventional as the presidential race itself.
In 1976, the last time a Democrat ran for president and won, I was able to cover TV's convention merely by watching CBS, NBC, and ABC. They did so much back then that not even PBS got very involved. But since then, cable TV has exploded, and the fortunes and audiences of CBS, NBC, and ABC have sort of imploded. In 1992, CNN has done the wall-to-wall coverage the networks used to do, while C-SPAN, sticking to the podium speeches, was the true network of record, something that got the commercial networks off the hook. And as a cost-cutting effort, the NBC team, including Tom Brokaw, showed up on PBS while waiting for its own network to clear time on NBC. You also had Comedy Central getting into the act, trying to do to convention coverage what Mystery Science Theater 3000 does to movies. In other words, ridiculing them instantly and constantly. Counting the trim-backed primetime reports by CBS, NBC, and ABC, that made seven different networks offering live convention coverage. And I'm not even counting the news briefs and features from MTV, the roundtable discussion on black entertainment television, or Dr. Ruth, working as a floor reporter for the Nostalgia Network. What happened with convention coverage this year is the same thing that's happened with the presidential campaign itself. It's escaped from the evening newscasts and network specials and spilled out all over the place. And from CBS to CNN, everyone is analyzing and criticizing campaign ads and photo opportunities rather than airing and accepting them at face value. Almost everybody in the process, from Comedy Central's Al Franken to CBS's Dan Rather, feels this is a good thing. When it comes to covering the candidates in the convention, the more the merrier. I agree, and there's a sense of balance when it comes to unscripted remarks on the talk shows. And speaking of more and merrier, nothing's fascinated me more this week than Tom Brokaw's live conversations via satellite with Jay Leno on The Tonight Show. During these nightly segments, Leno's interest in politics dovetailed perfectly with Brokaw's sense of humor, which on the NBC Nightly News is understandably stifled. After the first night of the convention, Brokaw laid out the Democrats' goals like this.
Democrats are not nearly as much fun when they try to behave. I mean, that's part of the problem. And they came here. They came here determined to present a new image to the country. And what they want to do is pretend that they can come to the dinner table and eat with a knife and fork and have table manners just like everyone else. And
last night, his remarks about Perot were very, well, let's just say undiplomatic.
It is a little hard to figure out the parallels. He's one of his heroes is John Wayne, and this is the political equivalent. As soon as the bad guys show up, John Wayne says, see you later, guys, you're on your own. I'm out of here. I don't know. I think it just turned out to be a more taxing proposition from a personal point of view than he expected. A friend of mine once said about American politics, if you want to run for president, you have to be prepared to go into the busiest intersection in town at high noon and take a bath in public. And maybe Ross Perot didn't want us to see his tiny little body at that hour.
Really, really.
What's going on here exactly? Al Franken said it best in his opening night intro to Comedy Central's sarcastic coverage.
It is perhaps fitting that Comedy Central is bringing you almost twice the coverage of any of the major broadcast networks, living as we do in an era where the wall between news and entertainment has been eaten away like the cartilage in David Crosby's septum.
But that's not necessarily bad, so long as these efforts add to, rather than replace, serious coverage by TV news organizations. It's interesting that the talk show fever infecting presidential candidates this year has spread to Brokaw and certain others as well. And the way I see it and watch it, you can learn a lot more about the candidates and the news people in these informal settings than in a lot of stiff and formal debates. Which reminds me, tonight on CNN, Larry King's guest is Ross Perot. And you can bet the calling questions he'll get today will be a lot more direct and revealing than the ones he fielded from reporters in his live TV press conference yesterday. And next month, the Republicans get their chance in a convention likely to be covered just as creatively and differently as this week's Democratic convention. In 1992, TV is providing terrific opportunities to get to know the candidates and non-candidates a little better. You just have to know where to look.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. This is Fresh Air. One of this summer's movie hits is A League of Their Own, about the Women's Baseball League formed during World War II. John Lovitz plays a scout who recruits the character played by Gina Davis. Lovitz has been trying to prove himself in films ever since he left Saturday Night Live in 1990. He'd been with the show since 1984. He became best known for the characters he created, like Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar, the pretentious actor known as Master Thespian, Annoying Man, and a caricature of gay writer and actor Harvey Fierstein. I spoke with Lovitz last spring, and he told me how he created the character of Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar.
I got it from old movies when, you know, in the 40s, and I'd say, yeah, that's the ticket. And yeah, I mean, I didn't make up that phrase. And then it really started an inside joke between a friend of mine and I and a girl, and I was always trying to pick up on her, and she said she liked the guy with the fat wallet. So I'd say, well, you know, my dad just had 15 oil wells come in, and she'd say, yeah, right. And I'd say, well, I am a pathological liar. And then I was in the Growlings Theater, and I decided to write it up as a monologue, as a like a person at Alcoholics Anonymous when they get up and say, you know, I'm an alcoholic and here's my story. And I, not that that's funny, but I thought it would be funny if it was a guy like Pathological Liars Anonymous. And then the guy would get up and start telling how he lied and then just start lying about that. And the first time I did it, you know, I did it and people laughed. And then this engineer that worked at NBC came up to Lauren's office and said, oh, that's the funniest thing I ever saw. You should put that on more. And so it's because of the audience response, really, that you repeat characters. You know, it's not the other way around. It's the audience picks the hit characters, and then, you know, so you continue to do them.
But at a certain point, you gave up the character. What was that point?
Well, I'd done it so many times, and I just wanted to move on.
Mm-hmm.
After the second year, it was just kind of enough.
So you decided to stop it.
Yeah, people are, you know, on Saturday Night, they're kind of weird about that when the... You have a hit character, they
want you to milk it?
Well, no, they want you to do it, and then when it becomes popular, then everyone tends to, you know, because they're comedians, they tend to make fun of it and not really, you know, go, yeah, that. And it's a weird thing when you have a hit character, they're not saying, hey, that's great. They're kind of saying, like, making fun of it, because the show, I guess, is supposed to be like anti-culture, you know, or whatever, you know, against the establishment. So when you have a hit character and it becomes part of that, then they end up, you know, making fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then after, you know, it bothered me at first, and then after a while I go, okay, I get it, you know. But I kind of got tired of doing it, and then it made me feel good when I did Annoying Man my last year, and I just slapped it together and, like, you know, I just said, give me the costume, and I wrote it in like 30 seconds.
You want to describe the character?
I just trying to be somebody who's annoying in every possible way. And a very grating voice. And, you know, like, hello, how are you? You know, and if you listen to someone talk like that for a long time, it would start getting annoying. And then I would chew on tin foil and take a fork and, you know, scrape it against a pan. And, you know, really grating a chalkboard, you know, it was really grating. And it was just very silly. And in my opinion, it was very stupid. It was just being very silly. And it was taking a character like that, and then which was completely non-cerebral, just ridiculously silly and dumb. And then it became popular, and it felt good to me because a lot of the writers are from Harvard, and they're like, oh, they're trying to write really sophisticated, clever stuff that doesn't work a lot of times, and then you just come along with something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like,
So let me ask you about Master Thespian, your most pretentious actor. What was the what's the story behind the creation of that character?
Oh, well, I went to a college at UC Irvine, and there was a professor of mine, William Needles, who taught me Shakespeare. And when he would do it though himself, he'd say the opening speech from Henry V, the chorus, and was, "Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention," and he would say like, "Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention," like that. And I thought it was very funny. I thought it was very good, but very funny too. And I used to imitate him, and then I kind of put it together with, and then I wanted to be an actor, and an actor is that's what a thespian is. So I was like the master thespian. I was just joke around with my friend and say, "I'm the master thespian," because I just wanted to be a great actor. That was my goal.
One of my favorite sketches of the ones that you've done on Saturday Night Live was Harry Hanukkah.
Oh.
Did you write that?
No, Al Franken and Mike Myers wrote it.
Oh.
But I based it on, they wrote it and it was really funny. And then I based it on this actor, Ned Glass. Ned Glass talks like this. And he was the father on Bridget and Bernie. He was the Jewish father. He was in he's probably best in the West Side Story. He was Pops, who runs the drugstore, the candy store.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 15 years old...
What's wrong with you kids?
Well, when I was... if you see these movies, you know who he is. When I was 15 years old, I was at my best friend's house, and his father is a doctor, and Ned Glass was one of his patients. And I was 15, and my friend's father says to Ned Glass, "John wants to be an actor." And he says, "You want to be an actor?" He goes, "What would you do if you hurt your toe?" And I said, "I'd say, ouch." He goes, "Would you say ouch if you were Hercules?" And he goes, "You know what you have to do? Because you know what you have to know to be an actor? You have to know everything. You think you could know everything? You have to know everything." So as if he knew everything. And then he goes, "There was only..." He was the same in every... thing he played, and he was, he was a good actor and he was funny, but he was just himself. He was exactly the same. And he says, "There was only two actors who were never typecast: me and Paul Muni." Anyways, I never forgot him, so I. That's why. He was good. He was a funny actor. He's funny, but he never. I guess he always thought he played all these different characters, and really, he was just always. "Hello, how are you?" I mean, in Julius Caesar, in the movie with Marlon Brando, he's in the opening market scene, and everyone's going, "My lord, come here and hither." And he's in the market saying, "You want to buy some oranges, my lord?"
Were there any jokers in your family? Did you have a father who'd sit around the dinner table and tell jokes?
Yeah, he used to goof off, and he used to make prank phone calls, and... I mean, the look for annoying man I got from him. He used to comb his hair forward and wear his glasses low. He didn't act like that, but that's where I got the look from. And he used to do something. He used to come home and tell us he was his twin brother, Howard. We would be like 7 or 8. But he would play it so straight for like a half an hour and just insist on it. And then he would leave and then like 20 minutes later come back. I guess he would just wait in his car. And then we'd say, "Howard was here." He goes, "He was?"
So he really had a twin brother, Howard?
Huh? No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't?
No, he just said he did.
I see. Okay.
We were young. He would do stuff like that.
Is it difficult to convince casting directors that you can do parts outside of the types of characters you created on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, it's difficult. One time, I had met Dustin Hoffman before, and he said, "You're in my next picture," and I'd met him once. We had the same agency, and then I met him about 8 months later. He goes, "Oh, I didn't know who you were when I met you, and I've seen you. You're very funny. You're in my next movie." And then I ran into him again about a year later in the street, and I said, he goes, "Hey, how are you?" I go, "Good." I go, "Well, you said I was in your next movie," and then Rain Man came out, and I said, Tom Cruise, what happened to me? You know. So, so he laughed, and he goes, well, I met then, I'm bringing you into my next movie, which was Billy Bathgate, and he did bring me in. He was really nice, and he brought me in to meet Robert Benton, and he just said, well, I just think John, you know. Oh, well, what happened was there was a, on the table, there was the paper, you know, there was two copies of Billy Bathgate, the hardcover and the paperback. So I go in and I said, Robert Benton, so which movie are you doing, the hardcover or the paperback? You know, and they laughed. And then he said, well, this is a serious movie. And then Dustin Hoffman goes, yeah, now's not the time to be funny. And I went, oh. So anyway, we talked and you know, I was thrilled that he brought me in. And then he's saying, well, you know, where can, I just think John's great and he does the characters. Where can we fit him in the movie? What do you think of this part of it? And Robert Benton said, oh, I know, he can do anything, I'm sure, but I just think the audience will start laughing once they see him on the screen. And I said, well, yeah, they might laugh at first, but then, you know, after a few minutes, then it'll be fine, you know. So it wasn't a question of whether I had the ability, in Rob Benton's mind, whether I had the ability or to do it or not, but whether, like, you know, they'll see me and start laughing. But I don't know. So I didn't get in the movie, but that's all right. And so I don't know. I'll get the opportunity. You know, I don't know. I don't really view it as my problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if people want to limit, you know, you're on Saturday Night Live and you play, you know, a million, you know, what, five different characters almost every week, you know, for 91 shows, and it's. You know, and then people say, well, can you play this? And you're going, well, I guess I can do these 500, but this is, you know, no, this one style. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Everyone on the on that show, not only just playing myself, but Jan Hooks, Dana Carvey, Phil Hartman, you know, they're all tremendously versatile and really can, you know, play any style and any, you know, can do it.
Well, John Lovitz, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Lovitz is featured in the movie A League of Their Own. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the Democratic Convention now that it's over?
A couple of things, Terry. Linda Wertheimer will be wrapping up the convention from New York. I'll be analyzing the acceptance speeches of Bill Clinton and Al Gore last night with a professor of rhetoric. He says that Clinton at times used techniques perfected by Aristotle. The speech did run a bit long, and Clinton should have provided more signposts along the way for the audience. John Burnett reports from Texas on further developments in the Perot dropout story. Also, butterflies missing. Monarch butterflies, which winter in Mexico, have not returned yet in any great number.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Sidney Lumet is one of the few American directors who've managed to keep up a mainstream movie career from a home base in New York City. In fact, New York City is the subject of some of his films, like Prince of the City, Dog Day Afternoon, and Serpico. His latest picture, A Stranger Among Us, is set in the Hasidic Jewish community of Williamsburg in Brooklyn. Critic Stephen Schiff saw the movie across the river in Manhattan.
Is A Stranger Among Us good for the Jews? The answer is yes, very. But it's not so good for the audiences. You can just imagine the story pitch back at the studio. See, it's Witness, right? But with the Hasidim instead of the Amish, and a her instead of a him. Melanie Griffith plays, I love this name, Emily Eden, a waspy, hard-boiled detective who's sent out on a missing persons case. A Hasidic Jew named Yaakov has disappeared, and now she must sit in the office of the head rabbi, the Rebbe, and grill the young man's family, who, of course, wouldn't dream of talking to her out of the Rebbe's sight.
Is anything missing? Money? Jewelry?
Diamonds are missing, yes.
How much are we talking here?
Wholesale, about $720,000.
Well, look, I hate to say this, but I mean, if we're talking diamonds, we could be looking at a felony here. I mean, maybe your son ripped you off. I've seen it 100 times.
In your world, perhaps, not in ours.
Are you in charge here?
The Almighty is in charge.
That's Lee Richardson there at the end playing the Rebbe. And he's a wonderful actor, but even he can't take lines like these and make them into anything but matzah meal. The screenplay by Robert J. Avresh is impossibly hokey and movie-ish, and Sidney Lumet's direction plods along so lethargically that you have time to examine every fraying seam. The missing man, Yakov, turns out to have been murdered. And in order to find the killer, Emily Eden decides she has to live among the Hasidim, which means we get lots of sanitized little lessons in what they do and believe. Meanwhile, the Hasidim keep reeling every time Emily utters a four-letter word. And every time they do something sweet, she widens her big eyes and says something like, "Wow, you people really care about each other." It's like sister act without the crosses or the laughs. Of course, there's a romance. Emily falls hard for the Rebbe's son, played by newcomer Eric Thal. But Thal and Griffith have no chemistry, which means that the romance in the story has no weight. Everything else, meanwhile, weighs a ton. When 2 7-foot thugs out of a Godfather parody step in and start threatening everybody in sight, they're such obvious central casting goombas, and the movie is straining so hard to convince us that they're the killers, they might as well be wearing T-shirts that say Red Herring on them. By the end of the first half hour, you'll know who the killer is anyway. And by the time the movie decides to tell you, you won't care. What you might care about, though, is Melanie Griffith, who shows once again what an unusual actress she is, amateurish and convincing at the same time. Like Marilyn Monroe before her, she gives you the sensation that she had to learn all her lines phonetically. And yet, there's something about the way she exaggerates her sleepy sensuality and her candy cane voice that makes everything she does seem sly and ironic, even smart. What isn't smart is her taste in scripts. Coming after Pacific Heights, Bonfire of the Vanities, Paradise, and Shining Through, A Stranger Among Us is like a career coffin nail. If only that wise old Rebbe had given her the advice she really needs. Melanie, Bobola, fire your agent.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with writer Paul Monnett. A few years ago, he wrote an eloquent memoir about caring for his lover who died of AIDS. Since then, Monnett has lost a second lover to the disease. Recently, Monnett was diagnosed with AIDS himself. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.